mashed potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. We are rolling full force into the holiday movie season, and we've got some pretty big films. The first one is, of course, based on a book, Exodus, Gods and Kings. I'm sure you heard of the book. Top five, Chris Rock's new movie, The Captive. And I'm going to cover an animated film, The Tale of Princess Kaguya, which is a Japanese animated film from Studio Ghibli. So we got a wide variety of things to talk about this week. But first, we're also going to talk about some news. We're going to have the trailer park. We're going to have box office predictions later on, along with the world-famous DVD roundup. And if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
That's right, Ron Burgundy. Let's move right on into the news because we've got a lot to talk about. Let's just hit some movie development news first before we get a bigger chunk, which is the Golden Globe nominations. I just kind of want to comment on those real quickly. But first, of course, there was that big Sony hack where Sony's computer system got hacked, and there was an info dump on emails and inner correspondence, and there was a lot of stuff that people could glean from that, not just infighting between like Scott Rudin and Angelina Jolie, but some pretty crazy stuff that they were working on. One of the things was Sony, which only has the Spider-Man franchise to its name in terms of the Marvel Universe. And as we know, they've been trying to develop a Sinister Six movie, and they're trying to rebrand The Amazing Spider-Man because that's not as big as they wanted it to be. They were in talks with Marvel Studios to bring Spider-Man into Captain America, the Civil War, Captain America 3. Those have broken down. But you know what? This is going to happen. They're eventually going to have crossovers on these because people want it, and it's a way for all the studios to make money. So I think that's kind of cool. If you saw Spidey show up in the Marvel movies, the Avengers movies, the ones that are owned by Disney. Another idea that was tossed around, which I just think is funny, is they were kicking around an idea of a crossover between 21 Jump Street and Men in Black, which is completely bonkers of an idea. And I have a feeling this was one of those that would have never gotten off the ground and we would have never heard about it because it is just so out there and bizarre. And it's sort of an old guard, new guard kind of movie mashup. But in a way, I kind of want to see that. I kind of want to watch that movie as long as Will Smith doesn't take it over. In fact, I'd love it if it didn't have Will Smith or Tommy Lee Jones. They had different Men in Black. Or if they were trying to get the guys from 21 Jump Street to join the Men in Black and just leave Tommy Lee Jones and Will Smith on the curb. That would be kind of cool. Another piece of development news is we've got Robert Orci is out of Star Trek 3 as director. Of course, they're scrambling to get this movie made before the 50th anniversary of Star Trek. It's going to happen, and they'll get a new director. Jonathan Frakes has thrown his hat in the ring as wanting to. Now, of course, he played Commander Riker in The Next Generation, but he was also the director of a couple of the movies. Insurrection wasn't very good, but First Contact was quite good. So I don't know. I think it'd be interesting to see. His best directing work has been in the Star Trek franchise, so I think he'd be an interesting choice to bring in the old sensibilities back into the new Trek. And then, of course, if you are into Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, it turns out that Bebop and Rocksteady, the two weirdly deformed pachyderms from the cartoon, are going to be in TMNT 2, which I kind of look forward to. Just get rid of Megan Fox. I don't want to see her anymore. I'm tired of Megan Fox. And then real quickly, a note on the Golden Globes. The nominations for this and SAG and a lot of early awards have come out, and I'm just going to brush on it really quickly. Not a whole lot of surprises. The big ones that are sweeping and getting a lot of nominations, the only one that I did not like as a movie was Boyhood. I'm not a big fan of Richard Linklater. I thought it was an interesting experiment to film it over 12 years, but I just didn't find it all that compelling of a film. But the other movies that are getting a lot of buzz, The Imitation Game, Selma, The Theory of Everything. You've also got Gone Girl and The Grand Budapest Hotel. I love those movies. I think those are really good movies. Birdman is also getting a lot of note. So there's not a whole lot of surprises in the movie sections of the Golden Globes, but that's okay because I actually think most of the films deserve it. Whereas every year there always seems to be a couple of them thrown in there where I'm like, it's not that good. And that's how I felt with Boyhood. But we'll see. Hopefully that doesn't win anything major. I'm going to talk a little bit more about award nominations later in the show when I'm going to be talking about the Online Film Critics Society, their nominations, because I was part of that. that sound means it's time to leave the news behind and move into the trailer park. The first one I want to talk about is San Andreas, which these are two big summer movies that are coming up. San Andreas opens on May 29th, and it's a disaster movie. It stars Dwayne The Rock Johnson.
I cannot emphasize this enough. You need to get out. And I mean now. Because even though this is happening here in California, you will feel it on the East Coast.
Everybody down!
There's not a whole lot of depth to this. This was a teaser. This was dropped to show, hey, look, we can destroy Los Angeles with a computer. And it looks like it's a typical disaster movie. It looks like a return of movies like Volcano and The Day After Tomorrow. There was a big resurgence of disaster movies after Roland Emmerich kind of took the stage in the mid to late 90s. And we've had a couple of them, but I think the really last sweeping disaster movie was 2012, which was from 2009. So it's been 5 years since Emmerich has done something like that. But this is also, you know, it's a good old-fashioned disaster movie. I mean, it looks like Volcano, only with an earthquake, which I'm okay with. I think these are just perfectly acceptable popcorn movies. The next one I want to hit is Terminator Genesis, which opens on July 1st.
Come with me if you want to live. Now, soldier!
This is all wrong. John sent me here to save you.
From the Terminator that was sent back to kill me, I know, but we already took care of him.
We?
I've been waiting for you.
This one's interesting because I'm a huge fan of the Terminator story. I remember watching the Terminator, the original, back in the 80s when, and I didn't see it in the theaters. I had to wait till it got out on video cassette. Video cassette. That's how old I am. I was watching movies on VCRs. I saw Arnold Schwarzenegger joke about James Cameron back when he was making, he said back in his independent, cheap, you know, micro-budget filmmaking days with movies like The Terminator, because by the time you got into the 90s, James Cameron was doing $100 million budgets. He was always breaking the bank with budgets with stuff like Terminator 2, which was at the time the most expensive movie, and then he had Titanic, which was the most expensive movie, and then he had Avatar, which is the most expensive movie ever made. Terminator, I always loved the first Terminator. I thought that that was Cameron at his best because he didn't have at his disposal all the money that he has now. And while I enjoyed Avatar and Titanic, the Terminator, there's something organic about making a low budget movie. So this one is going back in time. Of course, the movie originally starts with time travel. So when they do time travel, it's not like a cop out, but it's them bringing back and recasting Kyle Reese and Sarah Connor. And Kyle Reese, I still can't get past the fact that you took a great sort of B-movie icon actor from the 80s, Michael Biehn, who played Kyle Reese, and you replaced him with Jai Courtney. Does anyone care about Jai Courtney? Jai Courtney keeps showing up in stuff. He shows up in Unbroken, which is that Angelina Jolie movie. He's in the Divergent. Nobody cares about Jai Courtney. Jai Courtney is like Sam Worthington, where he happens to be in movies that do well, but I don't think anybody cares about this guy. I think that if they cast Jai Courtney and Sam Worthington together, and I had a friend on Twitter, Clayton Walker, a friend of mine, said, well, you could also have Taylor Kitsch show up in this movie, and a giant black hole of the universe not caring would open up and absorb everything. Jai Courtney plays Kyle Reese. I think he's going to be a detriment to the film. The girl who plays Sarah Connor, she at least seems to be emulating a bit of Linda Hamilton. So, I don't know. It has some parts that look interesting. Supposedly Matt Smith from Doctor Who is supposed to be in this movie. I'm curious to see it. I'm curious for this movie because at least it looks like it's trying. And it's got Schwarzenegger back, so that's always fun to see. We'll see what happens. I have not completely dismissed Terminator Genesis, although I am walking in with great trepidation. That's it for the trailer park. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Top 5 and the Tale of Princess Kaguya.
Thank you.
ho, ho, Merry Christmas. We only have a couple more weeks of life before Christmas, before it's all kind of said and done. This year has been very fleeting. We had kind of a late Thanksgiving, so we only had like a couple weeks of Christmas. I mean, right now, it's like a week and a half to Christmas. It's not very far. Have you done your Christmas shopping? I finally did mine. I do all that online. I don't go to brick and mortar stores anymore. Not at Christmas time. And what's funny about me with Christmas, since I see movies, I watch movies for a living. A lot of times they send me screeners, and which is great because I love watching the screeners at home. In fact, I got a screener for Top 5, which I'm going to be talking about here in a second. I love watching the screeners at home because I don't have to leave. I don't have to leave my house. I don't have to take the time to drive to the theater, get there an hour early, sit and wait for the movie to start, and then after the movie drive home, I can sit at home, watch it at home, and it'll only take me an hour and a half or 2 hours as opposed to a 3 or 4 hour ordeal with driving and waiting time. It also avoids the malls for me because one of the things that inevitably happens is one of the PR companies will schedule a movie like a week before Christmas at like the biggest shopping destination in the city. And I got to fight traffic just to go see a crappy movie. Fortunately, that's really not happening this year. By the time I'm in midweek of next week, I don't have to leave the house again until like New Year's, which is like a joy for me because I just hate people and in general, you know, dealing with drivers. It's nice to have the holiday season, but it's crazy busy for me because I'm watching movies. I'm watching 3-4 movies a day, not just at the theater, but at home because I'm catching up. I'm in 3 critic voting organizations. So, one of them that's getting a big push, which the BFCA for the Critics' Choice Movie Awards, CCMAs, which are going to be airing in January, those get a lot of, we get wooed a lot by Hollywood. And one of the movies that they're pushing, Scott Rudin is pushing as a producer, is Top 5. And in the film, Chris Rock plays a version of himself, a comedian trying desperately to promote his new serious film.
In 2005, Time magazine voted today's guest the funniest man in America.
I don't feel like doing funny movies anymore. I don't feel funny.
Save some of that stuff for your Times interview.
I just want a decent story. You give me a couple of really honest things, I will be more than fair.
Why don't you just skip the hack questions and go right to something good?
All right. How come you're not funny anymore?
Everybody's funny or drunk. You ever see Oprah drunk? She's hysterical.
What's interesting about Top 5 is it's sort of Chris Rock reinventing himself. And it surprised me that this was getting an awards push. I got a screener for it. I got an email from Scott Rudin. We've gotten some buzz that's being generated by the studio. And I think that that's really kind of cool. And I think it's cool for Rock, too, because his movies haven't been that good. Let's just face it. Down to Earth, Head of State, I Think I Love My Wife. These movies haven't been all that great. His probably his funniest stuff is still his stand-up. And if other people cast him in movies, he's very good. But when he writes and directs himself, he's really not that triple threat. And if you look at Head of State, Down to Earth, and I Think I Love My Wife, his earlier films, they're very expected. There's no big surprises. And Top 5 is very different. It's taken from a sort of a non-traditional approach where it's not a mockumentary, but it's told with sort of a documentary style. And it's non-narrative filmmaking. It has a story to it, but it's a lot more vignettes and bits and pieces and stories that he probably draws from his personal life because he, of course, is famous and he's done big movies and he's been at the top of the heap and he's been called the funniest man in America and he's had his ups and downs. And there's a weird irony here that even though this is a comedy, and it's very funny at times, extremely funny, it is probably a more serious attempt at filmmaking that Rock's ever done. I mean, he's kind of been the poor man's Adam Sandler for a while in making his own movies, just never really clicked. But this one kind of works. I mean, it really does. It's very funny. It has some very hilarious interactions. It's very raunchy, too. So I caution anybody to bringing a kid to this movie, because when it says it's an R-rated movie, it's not just Chris Rock dropping F-bombs and throwing around the N-word. There's some pretty ribald stuff going on. I mean, there's hangover level raunch in this movie, and that's extremely funny and extremely outrageous and a lot of fun and very gross at times, but it's still very entertaining, but it's not for kids. Trust me, it's not for kids. Unless you need to, you're going to have some really interesting conversations on the way home when they say, why did this happen? You know, you've been warned. So, Top 5 is a funny movie. I got to hand it to Chris Rock. He did a really good job. And I'm glad that they're giving him an awards push for it. I don't know if it's going to win anything. it's tough when it's a comedy. But I mean, in terms of, it's probably the best movie that Chris Rock's directed. So that's a good thing. So I'm going to say that top five rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys in the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's move on to The Tale of Princess Kaguya. Based on a Japanese folktale, this story follows a bamboo farmer who discovers a magical child in the woods and raises her to be royalty.
I have heard the rumors about her.
Oh my. If disobedience to His Majesty is considered a crime punishable by death, well then, the only choice is to kill me.
You mustn't blame yourself.
Do you really want to hurt your father like this?
Please don't take me away.
This is released by Studio Ghibli, and that is most famous. A lot of people who are in the mainstream aren't aware of Studio Ghibli, but they're aware of some of the movies. Hayao Miyazaki, who did last year's The Wind Rises, was supposedly a swan song, but apparently he's coming back to doing some directing. He's the guy who directed movies like Ponyo and he did The Wind Rises last year, and he did My Neighbor Totoro, well known for doing Spirited Away, which won an Academy Award a dozen or so years ago. It's not Miyazaki doing this film. It's another guy who did My Neighbors the Yamadas, which is an old movie from about 15 years ago. That's a charming little Japanese kids movie, and they're kids movies at heart. I mean, Studio Ghibli does movies. It's animated films, and it's for kids in a way. But there's a lot of maturity and artistry that goes along with these films. And I gotta say, I think just the style of Princess Kaguya is beautiful. I mean, it's done in this sort of sketched watercolor manner that's very different than what like Miyazaki usually does. So it differentiates itself that way. And it shows that Studio Ghibli isn't just a Miyazaki puppet. It's doing a lot more. It does a lot more than just Miyazaki's work. It's a folk tale. So it has the trappings of a folk tale where it tends to draw out at times. It's like over 2 hours. It's a long movie, but it's beautifully animated. It has very typical characters in it, a feudal Japan of them. What it is, he's a bamboo farmer and he finds this magical child and he finds gold with her, uses the gold to build a palace and bring her into royalty. And it's her growing up and wanting the simple life, but being sort of thrust into the royalty life, into the more traditional life. And what it shows that while there's no want for food or protection or clothing or shelter in the blessed life, she wants what she had as something a little more organic, something a little more, you know, sweet, and there's a lot of longing there. So it's a very bittersweet movie, a very beautifully animated movie. It's something that you know, if you're going to choose between top five and Princess Kaguya, you're going to want to take your kid to Princess Kaguya. That's definitely the better choice for kids. I'm going to say that The Tale of Princess Kaguya rocks. It's a beautiful movie that works very well and fits in with the Studio Ghibli canon.
It rocks.
Excellent.
All right, I need to go to a break, and when I come back, I'm going to be talking about a couple more movies. We've got Exodus, Gods and Kings, and The Captive. Kevin Carr with Fat Guys at the Movies, rolling on in like Santa. I'm very much like Santa. Not only am I bearded, have a glorious beard on my face, and it's going gray, which I don't want to grow my hair back in. I actually shave my head just because I think it looks better on. It's a good look on me. Not quite a Santa look, but it's a good look. I'm afraid to let my hair grow back out to not just see how far it's receded, but to see how much salt is in the pepper on top of my head. But I'm also fat like Santa. And since you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies around Christmas time, it is Christmas time in the movies. And nothing says Christmas more than Passover. Not really. But Passover is involved in our next film, Exodus, Gods and Kings. Ridley Scott directs this biblical epic about Batman leading the Israelites out of Egypt.
Moses, they are animals. I will drown him in the Nile, as you should have been.
Oh,
think so.
What is it?
Ramesses, 4,000 men, 1,000 chariots.
Ready yourselves! You've honored me with your trust! If you stay, you will perish! Follow me! You will be free!
This is based on a book. I'm sure you've heard of it, at least. I don't know if you've read it, but you've heard of it. It's this little book called the Bible, I think is what it's called. I had not brushed up on my Old Testament Sunday school lessons before I went to see this movie. I kind of, you know, it's kind of like when I went to go see the press screening for The Hobbit. There's a part of me that says maybe I should watch the first two Hobbit movies again just to kind of catch up, because I was assuming that the third Hobbit movie kind of picks up where the last one left off. So there was that part of me that says maybe I should watch those again. And there's a part of me that says maybe I should read Exodus before I go see the movie. I don't have time to read. So I'm going on what I remember from Sunday school and going to church over the years. In that respect, as not speaking as a biblical scholar, it seemed to be relatively close to what I remember reading about and hearing about before. Exodus does not seem to be a movie that takes massive liberties with the large pieces of the puzzle. Where it takes liberties is in the character moments, because the Bible is not about characters. It has characters in it, of course. And it has great names and epic stories, but they're not character-driven stories. They're event-driven stories. In fact, the dialogue in the Bible, and I said this back when Noah came out, if you read the biblical accounts, they're pretty dry from an entertaining standpoint. They're more history and theology lessons than anything else. So the big challenge on making any movie, whether you're doing Noah, which Darren Aronofsky did earlier this year, or whether you're doing Son of God, that re-edited TV movie, or if you're doing Exodus, you kind of have to put character and dialogue in there, and more than just let my people go kind of dialogue. That's where this movie breaks down. And like I said, I can't discuss the nuances of the history because I just don't know them. I remember reading and studying about the plagues, and they have the plagues in there. And I remember reading and studying about the Red Sea parting and the actual Exodus and Passover and all these stuff that happens in the movie, the burning bush. You see all these things showing up. Now, it takes it from a different angle. It does some things a little bit differently. The parting of the Red Sea isn't as spectacular as the Ten Commandments parting of the Red Sea, or the History of the World Part 1 parting of the Red Sea, but it's oddly, how to say, more plausible, I guess you could say. There's a certain level of this that's the movie that I found interesting in that it's trying to show that it wasn't just magic. It was the hand of God using what's available to make something happen is the best way to describe it. And I thought that was kind of cool because it took the just snap your hand of God fingers and make it happen doesn't necessarily work in a dramatic sense. So while it has all those moments, it's the parts with Moses when he goes off in the desert and he has a relationship and he gets married and he has a kid. And, you know, I think Christian Bale's a great actor, but he's not a terribly warm and fuzzy actor. And his interpersonal relationships aren't what makes his best performances are the weird ones. He's like Johnny Depp. His best performances are the ones that stand out. What made him great as Batman wasn't his interaction with the other actors. It was his stoic Bruce Wayne brooding character. So he doesn't quite warm up to the audience in Gods and Kings. I actually have to say Joel Egerton as Ramses was actually pretty good. I think he had better moments than Christian Bale. Now, of course, there's this whole talk of it being whitewashed, and it is. Because you're talking about Hebrews, Israelites, you're talking about Egyptians, and I mean, Christian Bale and Joel Egerton are so not that. Everyone else surrounding them, they cast relatively close to the ethnicity, but they have these just wildly out of the, you know, the Hollywood version. Charlton Heston has, it's a history of these Charlton Heston movies. He plays completely out of his race. I mean, he played a Mexican in Touch of Evil. He played Moses, an Israelite, a Hebrew in the Ten Commandments. So there's a long tradition in Hollywood of whitewashing these characters. I didn't get too worried about that. I just thought the epic moments, the grand scale. This is Ridley Scott, the guy who did Gladiator, did Kingdom of Heaven. He also did Robin Hood. There's times where this movie is as epic as Gladiator, and it's awesome that way. And then there are times it's as not epic as Robin Hood was. His Robin Hood version with Russell Crowe was just sort of bleh. There wasn't a whole lot of excitement to that movie. And you kind of get a mix of both. It's a real up and down kind of movie, because there are parts of this movie where I'm just like, this is bad. This is not working. And then there's moments where I'm like, this is really cool. This is a grand, big screen realization of what I read about and studied when I was a kid on Sunday mornings. So it's sort of a half and half movie. Overall, I enjoyed it. I thought Exodus was far better than I was expecting it to be, but it's not some great movie. It makes more sense than Noah did. But it's very secular, and I know that's going to cheese some people off, but it's Hollywood. Come on. So I'm going to say that Exodus, Gods and Kings, kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's move on to the next film, and that is The Captive. Ryan Reynolds stars as a man whose daughter goes missing for 8 years. The movie follows his struggle to exonerate himself from suspicion and to find her.
You claim you didn't see anything suspicious when you looked back to the truck.
They've taken my daughter. I need to know right now, what are you doing to help?
This whole thing is his fault.
You people can't even do your job. All you can do is turn my wife against me.
If you think that I did this, you come here and you arrest me.
All right, what's going on? Ideas?
There's a kidnapper and there's a watcher.
They might be watching me.
Who's watching you?
This is a smaller movie. It's released by A24, which actually has had a banner year with movies like Under the Skin and Enemy and Locke. They've done some really cool stuff. This is not one of them, I'm sad to say. Because I actually kind of like Ryan Reynolds, and he's really seriously trying. And this is a bizarrely strong cast. I'm kind of surprised at the cast for this movie. It has Rosario Dawson plays a detective. Scott Speedman plays a detective. I think I'm going to butcher her name, but it's Marielle Enos from The Killing and World War Z. She plays the mother of the girl. The problem is, I'm not a big fan of her, and she brings with her such dour misery porn that you get with The Killing that it's hard to remove myself, because the part of this movie is bleak and dreary, because it's about a kidnapping, bringing a girl into a sort of a sexual slavery. Weird, but what's weird about it is it deals with this real dark element, but it never actually acknowledges the dark elements really going on. It's just a kidnapping, and they sort of put everything off to the side, but you're supposed to be so horrified with it. So it pulls its punches when it really shouldn't, and it makes it very humdrum at times because of that. The performances are fine. I think Ryan Reynolds does a fine job, but it just, at times, it just doesn't wash as a movie. Because on one hand, it's trying to be this grim, gritty, dour kidnapping drama that could really be happening. It's filmed in Canada, so it's got this Canadian side, which I think is interesting, because you're like, yep, those Canadians, they do bad things too. And in the same time, it's trying to be this grand plan that's going on that just doesn't quite work. So, I mean, it's a good shot, but ultimately I didn't really particularly like it. The Captive kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Oh, okay. All right, I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about the OFCS nominations, box office, and the world-famous DVD roundup. Welcome back to Fat Guys of the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk a little bit more about some award films. I'm going to lead in first and talk about the nominations for the Online Film Critics Society. Next week, we'll be talking about the nominations from the Broadcast Film Critics Association, which I'm also in. The OFCS is Online Film Critics Society. I've been a member of that for about 10 years, and we vote every year, and we're going to be announcing on Monday our winners. But right now we've had the nominations come out, And there's a part of me that has a certain pride in these nominations, because there are certain movies that you're seeing on everything. I mean, The Grand Budapest Hotel is all over our list. It's up for Best Picture. Ralph Fiennes is nominated for Best Actor. Wes Anderson is best nominated for Best Director. It's one of my favorite movies of the year. And so I'm very much behind that. You're seeing Boyhood, which I previously said I didn't particularly like, but I'm not surprised it's on here. It's on everybody's lists, and you're getting director nominations and acting nominations for that film. What's neat, though, is there's a couple things on our Best Picture list. The Lego Movie's in there, which I think is awesome, because the Lego Movie is a great film, and there's a certain group of people that are like, oh, it's an animated film for kids, and it's very popular, it's mainstream, it's corporatized, it's not real art. And there's a brilliance and lovability to the Lego Movie, and I'm glad to see, I'm proud that I was helping putting that on the Best Picture list. There's other ones like Nightcrawler, which actually made the Best Picture list, which is kind of surprising. Selma, which is also a great movie. But the other one, Whiplash, is on there too. I was going to talk about Whiplash this week, but I just didn't have time. But also the other one in the Best Picture category is Under the Skin, which is the Scarlett Johansson movie where she plays this alien creature that preys on men and like absorbs their essence under their skin. It's very mysterious and very weird. It's another A24 release, which is a fantastic film. So it's neat to see that on there. The Tale of Princess Kaguya is actually on the Best Animated Feature running. Under the Skin, Jonathan Glazer also gets a Best Director nomination. The Babadook, which I talked about a couple weeks ago, a fantastic horror movie by a new director, and she does a fantastic job in it. She, unfortunately, wasn't nominated for Best Director, but Essie Davis, who's in it, was nominated for Best Actress. These are things that are nice to see showing up. We've got Foxcatcher showing up on the list. We got J.K. Simmons for Whiplash showing up for Best Supporting Actor. We also have Tilda Swinton for Snowpiercer, which was a movie that came out this summer, a very interesting film about the end of the world on a train. And Tilda Swinton does a pretty cool transformative performance in that. Go to ofcs.org and you can see the full list. It is definitely a list of movies that are different than some of the bigger ones. And you're going to see some movies on that list that you aren't seeing in the same categories. And I'm proud to be part of that. Next week, I'll be talking about the BFCA nominations for the Critics' Choice Movie Awards. You're listening to Kevin Carr with Fat Guys at the Movies, and let's move on into the box office. Last week, I made the pretty safe bet that Mockingjay was going to win the box office, and I said only $20 million for that one. I was actually pretty doggone close. I've been really close with Mockingjay. I've been surprisingly good at predicting what Mockingjay was going to do. It did $22 million last weekend. It's its third week of release, but that's still, it's dropping. It might cross $300 million. But I still don't think it's going to beat Guardians of the Galaxy for domestic gross. It's not going to make another $70 million, which is what it needs to beat Guardians of the Galaxy. It was the only new movie that was out was The Pyramid, and that came in ninth with 1.4 million, which is pretty pathetic. They could have put something else in there. Now, Wild made $600,000 in only 21 theaters, which is really, really good. It made way more per screen than The Pyramid did, but that's it in terms of the really new big movies. This week is going to be much more interesting because we got to see what happens if Exodus is going to win, if it's going to do well. It's getting stuffed into December. This was not a great time to release. I think Easter would have been a better time to release this because that's sort of around the time you got Passover that you can connect with it. It's not a Christmas story. Now, Noah did very well, but I think Exodus is going to get lost a bit in the shuffle because you've got The Hobbit coming out next week, and it's just a very crowded marketplace. In the next 2 weeks, we're having like 512 movies opening. So I think it's still going to do well enough. I think it's still going to beat the rest. I think it's going to make about $35 million. So Exodus, Gods and Kings, I'm predicting will be $35 million at the box office for this week. And Mockingjay, I think top five is, if it can make $10 million, I think that's great. I think it has a possibility. I think top five is going to have a better showing than you'd expect for a Chris Rock film. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound now means we can roll into the world-famous DVD Roundup. starting off the list is one of my favorite movies of 2014, and that is the top domestic grosser. Guardians of the Galaxy is now available on DVD, on Blu-ray, on 3D Blu-ray. This is an absolutely fun movie. It is as fun to watch as The Avengers, but it's very different. And the reason it works is because James Gunn, the director, was doing some amazing things. He made this movie into something that it would have been more humdrum under a different director. And I was actually listening to the commentary, and they made a point. He made a point, and he said that when he wrote the script, Joss Whedon, who directed The Avengers, read the script and told him, you know, you need more James Gunn in this movie. You need more humor. And that's what makes this movie work. And this was a real challenge of a movie. Not that Joss Whedon did a poor job with the, I mean, he did a great job with The Avengers, but he did have the advantage of having like five movies leading up to it. He did have the advantage of them all being established characters, and he had the advantage of it all taking place on Earth. Guardians of the Galaxy was a brand new movie with characters you've never heard of, a lot of actors you either aren't terribly familiar with in movies, or they're so obscured with digital effects or makeup. Like Zoe Saldana, she's all green in this movie, and Bradley Cooper is the voice of a raccoon. And then it all takes place in outer space. It's the whole movie takes place in outer space. And for me, who grew up with Star Wars, that was easy. I get that stuff. That's what I grew up with. I consumed science fiction movies ever since I was a kid. But to your average mainstream audience, who the biggest science fiction movie they've ever experienced would be Iron Man, this is a big deal. And it was the humor that took the pretty genocidal story that's happening in the film and made it accessible and fun and exciting. And it made it that classic space adventure that we hadn't had in a long time. I mean, it goes back to the original Star Wars movies that has that sense of wonder and awe. And of course, they've got all these special effects. And it's a very colorful film. And one of the things James Gunn also talks about in his commentary, he talks about how recently a lot of movies that take place in space are very monochromatic. They just don't seem to have the color to them. And space is colorful. Just look at some Hubble pictures, take pictures from telescopes of the nebulas and the different clouds of gas in the sky. It's amazing. It's beautiful out there. It's not just white stars on a black field. And I thought James Gunn did a great job making that happen. So Guardians of the Galaxy is out on DVD and Blu-ray, 3D Blu-ray. Totally worth picking up. Great for Christmas present. If you want to send me the 3D Blu-ray, the address is on the website. Dolphin Tale 2 is also out. I wasn't a huge fan. I thought this was okay. I mean, for the first Dolphin Tale, it's a cheesy, corny, inspirational movie. And I think for what it is, the Dolphin Tale 2 works. That one's out on DVD. Calvary, which stars Brendan Gleeson as a priest who is threatened in confession and has to decide whether or not to turn that person in and whether or not to go after that person and what happens as a result of that. Then there's Frank, the story about the band starring Donald Gleeson, who's Brendan Gleeson's son, and Michael Fassbender as the leader of the band who always wears a false head. Dead Snow, Red versus Dead. We talked about that a couple weeks ago. It's the Braveheart of zombie Nazi movies. And it's bizarre and weird and out there, and it's a great little zomcom to check out. Doctor Who Season 8, which is the full season of the first outing of Peter Capaldi as the Doctor. I'm a huge Doctor Who fan. I've watched it since the 70s, and Peter Capaldi's giving a very different version of the Doctor than we've had for the last three. The last three, Christopher Eccleston, David Tennant, Matt Smith, have all been young, quirky, whimsical, kind of, you know, sexy doctors. He's older. He's different. And I like they're going back to an older doctor, going back to the John Pertwee days. Under the Dome Season 2, the Stephen King show on CBS, is also available. The stinker of the week is When the Game Stands Tall, which is the film about football and religion. This one I just thought was just way too corny. It's so button pushy and heavy handed. Any sort of message and good intentions is lost. But that's about it. We are done for the week. Next week, we're going to be talking about more epic films. We're going to be talking about The Hobbit, The Battle of the Five Armies. That's all one movie. We're going to be talking about Night at the Museum, The Secrets of the Tomb, and Annie. The Sun will come out tomorrow, next week. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.